imaginary Gaussian integral. And then I will show you how to calculate the Gaussian integrals with Grassmann variables. So the latter topic will be probably more interesting because probably the larger number of you guys did not see this before. So what we did in the previous section, we showed that the average of two Gaussian variables, xk and xl, could be represented in this form as two derivatives with respect to two vector parameter beta, with respect to component of this parameter. First take derivative and then set beta equal to zero. So when you do this procedure, you will find out that when you take the derivative once, you will have the prefactor containing the sum over components of B in this form. So to have non-zero result, we must eliminate this prefactor before the exponent. Only after that, if we set B equal to zero, we will get something non-zero. So as a result, taking this derivative is equal to the KL element of inverse matrix A, of the matrix inverse to A. So this is what we showed last time by a simply straightforward observation of how things should work in order to get something non-zero. So I hope this is more or less clear if we have two Gaussian variables here, xk and xl. So if anything is not clear to you, then please don't hesitate to ask me questions. So this result can be generalized to the case where we have more than two variables. So we can, for example, consider four variables and consider the average of these four variables with respect to Gaussian weights. So xk1 times xk2 times xk3 times xk4, where k1, k2, k3, and k4, they are simply the indices. So instead of writing here k and l, I decided to write k1, k2, k3, k4, c, because there are many letters that could be involved in the algebra. So we can write the average of this also as the four subsequent derivatives of this exponent, the same exponent. For brevity, I decided to denote what stands there by multiple dots. So, again, in order to understand how things work, if we have more than two variables, say four, or even more than four variables, we should simply understand one thing. What happens if we first take the derivative, say, with respect to B with index k4, for example, what should happen? If we take this derivative, then we generate the same prefactor that involves the sum of elements of inverse matrix with all components of vector B. So we will have just this k1, k2, d over d, b, k3, and this stuff, a minus 1, say k4, m, bm, times exponent with the condition that we set b equal to 0 after taking all the derivative. So to eliminate somehow this b to get non-zero result, we must have one simple thing. We must have that we must have that one of m must be equal to either k3 or k2 or k1. So if m to K3, then we immediately get A minus 1, K4, K3. Because here, M is a dynamic index, and we have the sum over all bits. So we must have the term with M equal to K3. But after that, we are left only with two derivatives. And we should proceed in the same way as we proceeded here. So if K3 is paired with K4, then K1 should be paired with K2. And we have, from taking subsequently the remaining two derivatives, A minus 1, K1, K2. Is that all? No. No, this is not all. So because this M can be also equal to K2. In this case, we get one more term, N minus 1, K4, K2. So the remaining two derivatives give that A minus 1, K1, so K2, K4, here K2, and K1, here K1, K3. Plus the remaining option. And the remaining option is when M here is equal to K1. And after that, we will get the situation in which K2 is paired with K3. So we write N minus 1, so K4, K1, that A power minus 1, not A power minus 1, but the element of inverse matrix, I write this way, K2, K3. This is the result of taking all these derivatives and putting subsequent b equal to 0. If we look closer at what is written here, then we have quite a remarkable result that the average with the Gaussian weight of four Gaussian variables. So if you have any questions, they're just interactions. Or four Gaussian variables. Simply splits into sum of products of all pairs standing under the sign of average. So we can just write that the average of xk1, xk2, xk3, x4 is equal to the sum of products xk1, xk2. Here xk3, xk4 plus xk4, xk2 times average xk1, xk3 plus average of xk4, xk1, average xk2, xk3. So what's this? This formula, if we put into red box this side and this side, I hope that you can see this. So this is called, let me write there, this is called Weeks theorem. Weeks theorem. So I think that it is quite straightforward to generalize this result if you have more than four, the average of more than four Gaussian variables. Obviously, the number of x's here must be even. If the number is odd, then you get identically zero due to the fact that you have to set b equal to zero. So the even number is important here. On practice, so you will be dealing with the situations in quantum field theory where matrix A is diagonal. So if matrix A is diagonal, then the inverse matrix is diagonal as well. So in this sense, the results, the applications that you will see later will be similar because it is always in practice easier to work, to perform averages with Gaussian averages with respect to diagonal matrices rather than general ones. So you can view this weak theorem as the most general case. So any questions at this point? So for those types of averages, you should just look and construct all possible pairs and correspond to each pair the corresponding element of inverse matrix. Any questions at this point? Because I will move further. Okay, if there are no questions, I will I would like to write here because this side is more convenient. If there are no questions, then we will consider also quite briefly the following sort of imaginary Gaussian integrals. I decided to spend some time briefly considering this topic that overlaps with what you saw during the tutorial. Because initially I was supposed to teach you a little bit of a continuation of what Tibor was teaching you, the calculation of integrals using the methods of complex variables. So, what we have here? We have here the following. Let's start with the following integral, I1 from minus infinity to infinity e in power I, a. I a x squared divided by 2 dx. So if you look at this integral, then you may see that this integral that may not converge. So indeed, this may be your first impression when you see this integral, but this is not true. Intuitively, when you try to analyze this expression, then due to the high power, this exponent and e in power I of something, this is cosine of that something, plus I sine of the same something, then this exponent gives you highly oscillating contribution because, say, cosine of f in some power n oscillates much faster than cosine of x itself. So intuition may tell you that this integral indeed converges because the contributions from to the integrals from the positive parts quench the contributions from the negative parts. So when x is large, the oscillations will become more and more frequent. And there is a hope that the integral, even if the upper limit is infinity, may give you some finite number. So indeed, this is a perfectly convergent integral. And to calculate it, let's first assume that a is greater than zero, and consider the following contour on the complex plane. So this is the complex plane Z. We consider the real axis, then take the portion of the circle in such a way that this line makes angle equal to pi over 4 with respect to real axis. So we start, say, from a rather far away point minus r. We have the intention to set r going to infinity. Then move along the arc with this radius r and until point, so that has some straight line passing through the center of coordinate, going back, and then we move along this arc until we reach the point of minus r. So this angle, pi over 4, is essential to calculate this integral. So let's denote this contour C1, this CQ, this C3, this one, and this C4. Why we should have the angle pi over 4, we will be clear shortly. But first of all, let me allude you to the following. This function integral is analytic. So it is essential that e to the power I a z squared divided by 2 is analytic. Yes, we know that at the theory of complex variables, but the exponent of some analytic function is also an analytic function. In fact, exponent is the most pleasant function we can have in complex analysis. So exponent of a polynomial is always an analytic function. And if the function is analytic, then the integral of the integral over this closed contour, and this is the closed contour despite the fact that the lines overlap at zero. But zero is not anyhow special point, right? Everything is analytic, so we can consider this contour as a closed contour. So the integral over this closed contour must be equal to zero. So we can just write that zero on the left contour equal to the integral over C1 instead of for brevity I'll write e in power I a z squared divided by 2 plus integral over C2 plus integral over C3 plus integral over C4, right? And this must be equal to zero. So let's consider what we have. First of all, if we take the limit r going to infinity, then the integral over the portion C1 e in power I a z squared over 2 dz is our nice integral I1. Right? Then, this is at C1. Good.
The limit.
This is the integral over this real axis. I decided to call it C1. It's in fact from minus infinity to infinity. Yes. Yeah, when we take when we take the limit r going to infinity, then what goes along the real axis is our original integral I1. Is this clear? Because z is equal to x on the real axis. Good. Very good. I have just space here, so let me write here. Let me use this space. So at C1. So at C2. So what do we have at C2? I decided to spend some time so that you could figure out easily how to calculate more complicated integrals when you have whether you have more complicated polynomials under exponents. So this is just the simplest case. So at C2, what do you have at C2? At C2, Z is equal to R times E in power I theta. So if this angle, this angle is theta, then our theta goes between 0 and pi over 4.
Dennis, could you please write a little bit larger so that they can see it?
Okay, thank you very, very much.
Thanks.
Yeah. Let me apologize to Yaro who probably watching that.
Yeah.
So good. Write larger and use other words. Then what we have? E in power I A Z squared divided by 2, right, equals to exponent E A over 2 R squared cosine to theta plus I sine to theta. So A is positive. So far we can see that A greater than 0. And this is essential when we take this formula. So what do we have here? We have here I times I. We are going to have exponent of negative of some real number. So is it going to be positive or negative? So the real part of the of what stands under exponent is negative, because sine of 2 theta, given that theta varies between 0 and pi over 4, is greater than 0. So this is positive. This is positive because 2 theta goes from 0 to pi over 2. And sine of this is positive. So I times I will as minus, so A is positive, and this is positive. So this thus must go to 0 as R goes to infinity. So R squared grows up quickly, and the integral from this R, if this R is moved to infinity, turns it into 0. So we're not going to have any contribution from this R if R goes to infinity. So very, very good. So let's look at the arc C4. We have the same. At C4, the same. Integral goes to 0 as R goes to infinity. Now, what about C3? At C3. And at C3, we do the following. We make the substitution Z equal to S times E in power I pi over 4. So what's this? This is just the rotation by angle pi over 4 on the complex plane, right? So if we multiply by phase factor, we're effectively rotating all paths by pi over 4. So we're going to have the point E in power I A Z squared divided by 2 goes to exponent E I A divided by 2 S squared E in power I pi over 2, right? That gives E in power minus A S squared over 2. So then dz will be just E in power I pi over 4 ds. Good. This just means if we collect all this, that we will have that the integral over C3 will be equal to E I pi over 4 So is it, we have this prefactor exactly ds e in power minus a s squared over 2n. The limits of the integral at this point from plus infinity to minus infinity. Because we go from this way. So this just means that we have minus integral from minus infinity to plus infinity. E in power I pi over 4 is square root of pi. Then we have ds times e in power minus a is square root divided by 2. So, and this is going to be minus 2 pi I divided by a and square root of this. So, what are we going to have as a result of equating to 0 the total integral over contour? We're going to have I1 minus here, minus 2 pi I divided by a equal to 0. Hence, we have that our integral I1 equal to 2 pi I divided by a and square root of this. So why did they spend so much time? Because it's a very funny exercise to investigate. I know you of course could well. Good exercise to calculate the integral from minus infinity to infinity of e in power I a x in some power alpha. Say, I'm not going to divide by 2 or the prefactor, say AA is the prefactor, times the S. And investigate, just in the investigate how it behaves as a function of A and L. So exercise equal to as a function of A and F. Very good. Very, very, very good. And in fact, after that, you can just construct more complicated integrals, say the integrals with some other powers of X in front. But it's just you can investigate how it behaves. So it's the result will be quite interesting by choosing the appropriate contour. Okay. One more remark. So and this up. So, just a brief remark. So, we had a greater than 0, but can we have a smaller than 0? Any suggestion? What happens if a is smaller than 0? Absolutely, we have a greater than 0. For a smaller than 0, we have the same result. That I1 equal to square root of 2 pi I over a. So, but to see this, we should take this. But to see this, instead of the contour written very, very far up, we have the contour this one. It's a good exercise to check too. So, but of course, So A, of course, cannot be only equal to zero, but it can be both positive and negative. So nothing is surprising, because first of all, we already have the complex result for the integral. So, and if A is a regular parameter, then what prevents us from continuing analytically from positive part of the x-axis through the onto the negative part of the x. Moreover, A can be even complex, but in this case, the imaginary part must be of appropriate sign to ensure the convergence. But we will be dealing with the real case. So this is just remark one and remark two related to this. So remark two from comparison of I equal to the integral of e bar minus a x squared over 2 to the x and a I 1, I deliberately denoted it as I 1 equal to minus infinity to infinity e power I a x squared divided by 2 to the x. So this is equal to square root of 2 pi divided by I, and this is equal to square root of 2 pi I divided by A. So this result obtains, from this by simply putting A equal to minus I A. Right? Right, so from comparison, we can write down, let me squeeze this in that space, we can write down the formulas for the general case. I, A, B equal to, so product of dxi exponent minus 1 half. X I A I J X J plus B I X I. So write equal to. So let me end for my So equal to 2 pi to power n over 2 if we have n x variables divided by the square root of that a, so x 1 half b I a minus 1 I j b j. So from comparison of those results, we can write down straightforwardly the result for I1 A B integral over N parameters X I over 2 X I A I J X J plus B I X I equal to 2 pi I in power N over 2 divided by that A, the square root of this, times X I over 2 B I A minus 1 I J B J. So what we in fact did, we in fact substituted aij2 minus raij, and the inverse matrix goes with plus ij. Let me hold my breath a little bit after writing these lengthy formulas. I hope that they are okay. So why did I decide to write explicitly those things? Because in field theory, you will see both cases of Gaussian integration. So what we have done here by simply multiplying by I and minus I will be known later for you in field theory courses as Wicks rotation. So this is the example of Wicks rotation. Just an example. In the courses of field theory, you will be dealing with Gaussian integration over diagonal matrices, and you will be explained what will be the result of Wicks rotation. In fact, in the hands, Wicks rotation is going from Euclidean space to Minkowski space. So here, this is just for these types of Gaussian integration. So Wicks rotation. So, yes.
So when you do this rotation, you should guarantee that you will not encounter any poles during the rotation, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Okay. Very good. Yeah. So, of course, the rotation must be in the appropriate place. Yes. But you will see this way. So this is just the general case. The time is running quite quickly, my friend, but that's good. I hope that this will be useful for you, what I have here. So David, can't you have a scene now? Or I have two people. So just ask. So, any questions? So, if there are no questions, then I will talk to you. Or start talking to you. I'm not going to consider this material for the next lecture, although it's also a useful material, but less important than this one. So, from my point of view, this thing can be probably important for people who work, who deal with fermionic fields in doing string theory and field theory. No, it is equally important, but of course it's better to learn from this something what I have talked about before. So let's see. Gaussian integrals with Grassmann. I will cover what I can cover, everything else is in my lecture notes, and those will be put on the wiki. So if you have any questions down the road, so don't hesitate to ask me. With Grassmann variables, so Anna spoke briefly, right, David, about Grassmann variables on her lectures in algebra. And you know what Grassmann variables are. So if we have set of Grassmann variables, to write, be a good Russian. Variables. But then those variables anti-commute. Theta I tends theta j equal to minus theta j theta I. So can I ask you an honest question? Just pay attention to me. How many of you never saw Gaussian variables? Just raise your hand. One, two, okay, good enough. Good enough. Let me then slow down and give you some advices. So Gaussian variables are not that scary as they may seem. See, when I first noticed them, and when I took the course on field theory, I never studied Gaussian variables. I basically studied those things by myself. So 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, and when I first looked at that, this seemed somewhat unusual to me. So how you can have some kind of variables and have them anti-commute? But my advice for you will be look at them with a smile, but with caution. Just smile when you see those things, because what we were taught at school is that 2 times 3 is equal to 3 times 2, and now we see that 2 times 3 will be 6, and 3 times 2 will be -6. So what I would recommend is that whenever you see the expressions involving Gaussian variables, first of all, you should determine for yourself, looking at such expressions, where the Gaussian variables are, in which order they stand, and are there any variables that are not Gaussian variables you don't have to worry about. So you see expressions involving Gaussian variables, you immediately observe and fix within your mind the order in which they set. They set. That's essentially all. Otherwise, if you start doing manipulations with those, just say simple algebraic manipulation. Otherwise, things will be not that bad as they may seem. I'm not a specialist, frankly speaking, manipulating those variables to a considerable extent, but I dare to think that there is a limited amount of algebraic manipulations you can do with Gaussian variables. So this is for I not equal to j. So you have a set of those variables. So there's some kind of abstract beasts that obey this rule. So if I is equal to j, then you have theta I squared equal to theta I is equal to 0. What does this mean? This means that if we have a function, just a function of one irrepressible variable, then and this function is saying Taylor expandable, that we can write only that this function can have the form a plus b theta, where a and beta are some prefactors that are not Gaussian variables. So in your expressions, it is important to distinguish between Gaussian variables and not Gaussian variables. A plus beta m, that's all, because all other terms in this Taylor expression are equal to 0. So if you have the function of 2 Gaussian variables, say theta 1, theta 2, then the only thing you can have is a plus b 1, 1, theta 1 plus b 2, theta 2, plus can you have something else? Yes, you can. You can have the term that gives you c, theta 1, theta 2. So this term can be written as minus C 32, 31, if you assume this rule. So, good. If you have more than two grasping variables, then you will have more terms in the series that can be rewritten accordingly. Remember, you can have at most in each expression in the sum at most one Grassmann variable of the certain, so from a certain list of such variables. So if we have n Grassmann variables, we're talking about the algebra above the space of n Grassmann variables. Very good. So, what was it involved? We assume that we have some of our function that is Taylor expanded. For example, I cannot think about having, say, this type of function 1 over e in power 1 over theta. I don't know what this may mean and whether this exists at all. So, when we determine what types of functions we can be dealing with, let's define the operation of differentiation and integration. So I will use this page. So differentiation. So if we have f of theta equals to a plus b theta, then the derivative, derivative will be defined by this expression, and of course the second derivative here simply does not exist. And this puts the difficulties how to define the integration. So the integration, operation of integration, is defined as that identical to differentiation. A very bizarre definition. Integration is identical to differentiation. This just means that integral d theta f of theta is equal to df over d theta. Please don't be scared of this. This is just a formal definition because in order to develop the theory involving Grassmann variables, we have to resort to something very, very bizarre, to something that may not have sufficient place in our minds so that we could analyze this from the first sight. So then the convention is then, the convention is that d theta equal to zero and d theta times theta is equal to 1. This is the basic definition of, better to say, the bread of integration over Grassmann variables. Note that the integrals don't have limits because it's just a formal operation. When we do the integration, then we don't apply any limits. We imply only those things. So it is essential that when we have the products of Grassmann variables, we must fix the order at which they must stand next to each other. So if, say, here we have one, then we imply that first must stand d theta, it's also an abstract thing, and then theta. D theta, theta, but not vice versa. It is really important. So the convention, if we have many Grassmann variables, so convention, is that d theta 1, d theta 2, d theta 2, okay, then so forth, d theta n, then theta n, theta 2, theta 1 is equal to 1. And the internal, first we perform the internal integrals. It's 1, d theta n theta, then next internal pair, d theta n minus 1, theta n minus 1, and so forth. This is 1. So here we have the numeration in ascending order, 1, 2, 3, and so forth. And here we have the numeration in descending order, and n minus 1, and so forth. This is just the convention. So we we just friend. We then can say that d theta 1, d theta 2. Theta 2, theta 1 is 1, but d theta 1, d theta 2, theta 1, theta 2, what will it be? If this is 1, then we, then if we exchange, minus 1, yeah. So convention this is very important. Only, of course, if we exchange those differential, we get back 1. So we can perform the linear operations on Grassmann variables. Basically, we can construct the linear combinations of those variables or otherwise perform the rotation in the space of Grassmann variables. So for example, if we have theta 1 and theta 2, we can define theta is equal to theta 1 plus I, theta 2 divided by the square root of 2, then and theta bar equal to theta 1 minus I, theta 2, divided by square root of 2. The linear combination can involve complex coefficients, but if theta 1 and theta 2 are independent Grassmann variables, then theta and theta bar are also independent. Theta bar are independent. Since in field theoretical applications, Grassmann variables are in fact the fermionic fields. They are related to fermionic fields, and fermions have the aggregation and annihilation operators, that you will be dealing with the variables that of such type, say theta and theta bar, basically barred variables and simple variables. So this is just the consequence of an application. Otherwise, they should be treated completely independent. So don't pay attention that one is the complex conjugate of another. So we can write that d, the integral d theta bar d theta, and typically in courses of field theory, you will have first bar, then not bar, of theta bar is equal to 1. This is just according to this definition. So I deliberately decided to put here square root of 2 to ensure that the Jacobian of transformation is equal to 1. But in reality, when you do the linear transformation over Gaussian variables, then Jacobian of this transformation stands not like it stands for real variables, but I'm not going to talk about this. So, and let's calculate our first, and we still have time, our first integral that was probably calculated. So d theta bar d theta, exponent in power minus theta a theta. Where a is just some non-Grassmann numbers. Here it doesn't matter whether it is complex or real. It's positive or negative, whatever. It's just non-Grassmann numbers. So once again, when you see the expression involving Grassmann numbers, first of all, determine for yourself where you have Grassmann numbers or where you have non-Grassmann numbers. So what are we going to do? It's just a function of two Grassmann variables. Let's do the following. Let's expand the exponent. 1 minus theta a theta. Can we have the second term in the expansion? No, because the subsequent term will involve 2 theta bars and 2 theta. So this integral minus is gives us 0, so d theta minus d theta bar d theta a can be taken away, it's just a non-Grassmann numbers, theta bar. So this is 0, and what's this? What's this? Let's recall our convention. How we should proceed d theta bar, d theta, and here we have theta bar standing first. So this is equal to minus this integral d theta bar d theta. When we exchange theta, the order of standing of theta and theta bar, we get the integral that coincides with this definition, or better to say with this convention. So this is minus 1. So this minus cancels with this minus. So it gives us simply a. It gives us simply a, and during the last 3 minutes, I will write right here. I will tell you how to calculate this simple integral. I equal to product d theta I bar d theta I exponent of minus I lambda I theta I bar theta I. I runs from 1 to n. So better to write this way. First of all, if we have n pairs of Grassmann variables, then keep in mind the applications to field theory, we are going to determine what it all means. So product from 1 to n of this, and this is important, means that we first have d theta bar 1, d theta 1, and so forth, d theta n bar, d theta n. So all those variables are independent, the differentials are independent as well, but this is what we imply. We should keep in mind that all pairs of Grassmann variables, all pairs of independent Grassmann variables commute. variables, independent variables themselves, are anti-commute, but pairs commute. That's very nice because we can essentially, many of you from the course of quantum mechanics know the Baker-Hausdorff formula, right? So we can write this as the product of differentials, I will skip for brevity, and for exponent, we can consider those pairs of theta I bar and theta I independent from each other. And we can write also as a product 1 minus lambda I bar theta I. Why? We first of all wrote the exponent of sum as the product of the exponents. I hope it is clear why, because pairs come in. And then expanded those exponents. So, and looking at the product of those guys, we immediately figure out what will be the only term that will give us non-zero result. This term will be in which the product of pairs in which each pair occurs only once. So as a result, we have product I1 from n of all lambda I. So if lambda I are the eigenvalues of some Hermitian matrix, Actually, in this case, the sign of lambda I is not important. It's not under square root. It's not in the denominator. If one of them is zero, then we get zero, nice. So if we have this, then we get that this is the determinant of this matrix A. No square root, and it is in numerator. So that's all for today. I hope what I represent you will allow you to generalize this result for a more complicated Gaussian integral. If possible to say so, because Gaussian integral for Gaussian variables is a somewhat more formal definition. So in the same way as we gradually proceeded for the first lecture and this one. Okay, lunch.